Thank you for surviving 3 hours of this course. So let's continue. What did we see yesterday in a long-winded and I know quite mathematical way is that using symmetries that now apply to some object called the action. And the action, remember, is something that is related to the usual Lagrangian dynamics. So thinking about this object, about the minimal action principle and so on, we can actually think about symmetries as ways of determining what kind of Lagrangians are allowed, what kind of actions are allowed. So what we did is to say, okay, cool, so imagine that I have no knowledge whatsoever. I haven't done an undergrad in physics. I didn't go through the usual electrodynamics. I didn't have my quantum field theory. I didn't have all this knowledge. That is a body of knowledge that has been brought to you thanks to very good scientists, let's say Dirac, Schrödinger, Einstein, and so on, who went out, thought about nature, observed nature, and thought on ways of writing mathematically the way nature was behaving. Right? The Maxwell equations, the fact that he defined an electric and magnetic field, then he also thought about how they are affected by charges, how they are affected by the movement of those charges, and so on. Those were empirical observations that he then summarized in the form of mathematical differential equations. The same for the Dirac equation. This is just statements about objects that you define, in this case is matter, electrons or other fermions, and the way they will behave, the way they propagate, the way they interact, and so on. Sorry, that's awful. Let me put it in shut up, please. Shut up. Okay, very good. But you know, it probably happened or occurred to you when you were a student that you were given these things and you were told, this is the equation, do stuff with this equation, right? So you were given the Dirac equation. And that was the right description of a Dirac particle. But you, I don't know if at any point you consider why is that the Dirac equation. So the way it was obtained is by thinking about the behavior of those particles and ways to write this mathematically. But why do we get this particular structure? So it all comes from thinking about that object, the action, saying, well, okay, the action, what does it depend on? It depends on space-time, and it depends on fields, and also the space-time derivatives. So that's what I want to think of. That's the abstract mathematical object. And then I could take this thing and say, I'm going to impose some kind of symmetries, some kind of transformations to all these objects, space-time and fields, such that the action will remain the same. So I'm going to see what kind of groups or what kind of operations I could do to these quantities, space-time and fields, so that the action will stay the same. So for example, I could say that I want to impose Lorentz symmetry. Or a Poincaré symmetry, when you also add the translations as well, to the space-time properties of my action. So the external properties of my action. And then by doing that, and just by thinking about that, you should be able to then derive the special relativity operations and the mechanics in special relativity that you had done, let's say, in first year undergrad. And if you take the limit of very small velocities, you will also be able to recover the Newtonian mechanics. This comes simply from by looking at the space-time properties, and again, the best place to look for this is the Landau book, you can see that the action that you can write down has to be proportional to an integral over the space-time interval. And from that, you are able to derive these things. But we know that the fields we want to describe not only have external properties, not only have mechanics, not only you know moving in space and time, they also have internal properties, internal symmetries. For example, the fact that particles have spin. And the spin is some form of internal symmetry. So what we learned yesterday is that the way to describe spin is using a single type of group, SU2, and that the different particles we know of, scalar particles, matter particles, spin 1/2, the force mediators, spin 1, all these guys are actually nothing but manifestations of the same symmetry as U2. They are different representations of the very same symmetry as U2. Okay, and that's lucky because as it happens, we would like to think of theories that have Lorentz symmetry. And remember, the Lorentz symmetry was SO3,1. And that symmetry happens to be contained SU2s in it. So it happens to be isometric to a couple of SU2s. And that was our gateway to be able to write down a consistent theory of particles with a spin and also consistent with Lorentz invariance. We did it for the difficult case, which was the fermion case. Okay, so for example, if you try to then do that for a particular representation of SU2, so spin 1/2 particles, fermions, we were able to then obtain that the only way in which we can write bilinears of these fields, fermions, is writing the usual kinetic term that you are used to. So that's invariant under Lorentz symmetry. And the only way I'm able to then write something that gives a mass or represents a mass for my fermion is this particular combination. Here I'm assuming this particle is charged, otherwise there will be another mass that is called a Majorana mass. I'm not going to enter into this, but I can discuss this later on if you want. So the Dirac equation, the equation that took us such a hard work for Dirac to obtain, right? Thinking, observing, deducing, and so on, leading to this equation of motion that then can be derived from a Hamiltonian, that then can be derived from a Lagrangian, all these intermediate steps were nothing but a manifestation of this structure. That's the underlying symmetry structure. And we were only able to find this gateway to write Lorentz invariance quantities by understanding the isometries, the duality you want, that there is between Lorentz symmetry and the symmetry that represents a spin. And that only happens, this kind of things only happens at the level of the Lie algebra, so at the level of the commutators. Is everybody with me? Cool. So now what we are going to do is to have a little bit more fun with SU2. I see you didn't have enough. And then we are going to use yet another way of obtaining as a manifestation of symmetry something we know that exists. And in this case, is we can also think about internal, still internal, but local symmetries. And those will lead to, as a manifestation, forces in nature. That's the next step. So first of all, I'm going to tell you a very simple story about a global symmetry, SU2 again, exploiting it a bit more in a story that has to do with nuclear physics. Whenever I hear nuclear physics, I'm like, oh my God, this is from the 50s. But it's such a simple story that is worth looking at. So it's about global symmetries, about the, and yet another use of SU2. Okay? And then we will move on into gauge symmetries and how, assuming that somehow nature wants to have gauge symmetry or wants to protect a gauge symmetry, then you get as a manifestation that those fields, for example, fermion fields, do have to be accompanied by these spin one particles, by these force mediators. So the whole thing, you know, the SU2, cross U1, SU3, these ideas will come from, again, imposing something on the action. Again, that's for a little bit later. Let's think now about nuclear physics. So you know about the neutron and the proton, right? Nuclear physics. The neutron, the proton, they form part of the nucleons, or the nucleus. With my pronunciation, there is no way you can distinguish nucleons with nucleus. I don't know, but nucleons. So we call them nucleons. We give them a common name because actually from the strong interactions point of view, they are the same, but they are not the same, right? And what are the differences between neutrons and protons? Charge. Electric charge is different. Anything else?
Mass.
Mass is different. Who is heavier? Neutron. Anything related to that that is different? Yes, huh? So they are not made of the same quarks.
Unstable?
It's unstable, exactly. Neutrons are unstable. Protons, as far as we know, they are stable. So they are not the same particles. But from the point of view of strong interactions, they are behaving the same. So we are going to exploit this. A symmetry that is not a real symmetry is an approximate symmetry. It's only part of your set of interactions that sees that symmetry as much as we can. And we are going to then use this symmetry to write a very, very successful theory of nuclear physics that was used for decades. It's still being used for in many applications. Keeps moving up. You think it would help? That's okay. Okay, so from the point of view of strong interactions, a neutron is a proton. And that is indication that there is some kind of symmetry we are going to obtain. And symmetries are important because if we have symmetries, we will be able to obtain predictions. Symmetries leads to conserved quantities, selection rules, dynamics that are set by these symmetries. You will be able to do estimates about what is possible and what kind of decay channels are possible and what are not possible and so on, all based on this kind of symmetry arguments. Now, it's not an exact symmetry. It's an approximate symmetry. And it's a symmetry that is only true for a certain part of your Lagrangian, for a certain sector of your interactions. In that case, only the strong interaction. As you mentioned already, electromagnetism doesn't see these two guys being the same. And in particular, if you pull them apart, the neutron will decay like that. In 15 minutes, the proton is stable. So they are not the same, but we are going to pretend they are. So to then start exploiting and even understanding what kind of symmetry will lead to this, this statement will lead to, what we do is to put them together. So, for example, we can build some object. It's not a Dirac fermion. It's some object that contains both of them. Let me write, for example, the proton up and the neutron down. Now, what is the proton and neutron? they are fermions, right? So where is this object? This object, I made a vector out of it, and inside the vector, there is a guy that is a fermion by itself, so it has its own degrees of freedom here. So think on this guy being its own little vector, and this neutron is the same, it's also a fermion, and it has its own little vector. So they are spin 1/2 particles. They are bound states, but they are spin 1/2 particles, baryons. Okay. So, and here we are going to then assume that at least for strong interactions, there is a common mass, that is the mass of the neutron and the mass of the proton. These are going to be our assumptions. Okay, so we know how the proton behaves. We know what is their equation of motion. It's a fermion, it's the Dirac fermion. So it's the Dirac equation. We know how the neutron behaves, the Dirac equation. So if we want to write a Lagrangian that encompasses protons and neutrons, so both nucleons, we will say, well, that is the usual Dirac equation for both the proton and the neutron. So my I here, it's just representing I1 and 2 represents the proton and the neutron. So I have a Dirac equation for my proton and a Dirac equation for my neutron. That's what this represents. And some mass, common mass term for both my proton and my neutron. Okay, these two guys. Okay, cool. Bye. All right, so by examining this Lagrangian, the only thing I need to do is to try to find a transformation on psi, on my big object, that will leave this Lagrangian the same. The transformation, once you see it, is kind of obvious. So I want to see what kind of transformations of this type can do. So now my object is a vector with two entries, the proton and the neutron. So I want a 2x2 matrix that is going to rotate these two. Okay, so U is a 2x2 matrix. And this 2x2 matrix is going to be part of unitary rotations in two dimensions. These guys, the entries of this 2x2 matrix are four real parameters. That's known as U2, but it's getting into this U2. Actually, U2, so let me just say what U2 is. Any element of U2 satisfies these properties. It's unitary. And then we also know that the determinant square is 1. So up to a possible plus or minus here, or a phase, this U2 is actually the SU2 we were talking about yesterday. So you can take U2 and say, well, that's SU2 up to a phase. And this phase choice, if you want, is what we call a U1. Am I losing you, or you are fine? Are you okay? So I realized that I can always rotate these guys with this kind of matrix, U2. And this is almost as U2 up to this phase. And when the only thing I'm saying, so this is the. Yeah?
So P and N are of themselves a little 2 vector. Shouldn't.
4 vector.
Yes. The spinor of P and N. So if you make. So psi It being P and N. I always thought that was a shorthand of the two spinors, so it's actually a four vector instead of a two vector.
You can represent them like this, yeah.
So if it's that way, how do you use a two by two matrix to rotate exactly a four?
Very good. That's always a bit confusing because objects in nature can have different properties.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we are saying that the proton or the neutron are fermions. So they have their own spinorial index.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they are Dirac fermions, and you can visualize them as being a four vector.
Mm-hmm.
And what you mean by that is that the gamma matrices, the derivatives, the masses, and so on, they will act on them as this four vector. But that's the spinorial properties. Now, that what this psi is a two vector of two spinors. And if you want, one way of talking about these guys to say that psi has two properties. One is you want the flavor, whether it is a neutron or a proton, and the other is being a neutron or a proton, what kind of a spinor or a spinorial quantity it has. So, for example, the gamma matrices will act only on this space, whereas this U2 here is a, sorry, this U over here is a matrix acting on the flavor space. So it's rotating the P and N, and it's not touching the spinorial properties. More questions? Yes.
That property that the determinant square has U1, does it, like if you multiply U by a phase?
Should it be mod squared?
It's mod squared.
Ah, yes, thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, indeed. Yes. Is this more clear? Yeah, it's up to the phase. It's the usual as you do. More question? So your question was that? Perfect. Okay. So essentially what it means is that I can take my U matrix that is going to rotate the protons and neutrons. And this is going to be a phase that can be whatever, and times another matrix, but now belonging to SU2. Okay. All right, so once you say, well, my Lagrangian that looks so cute. So when I talk about protons and neutrons, I realize that there is an additional symmetry that appears as I consider their masses to be the same. And that symmetry is not just an SU2, it's an SU2 cross U1. So for each symmetry you discover, you are going to get a Noether current. I never know if I pronounce it correctly, but you know what a Noether current is. Awesome. And the Noether currents will be the one that corresponds to SU2. It's what is called isospin. So there is a property of nucleons, a symmetry of nucleons that is called isospin. And of course, isospin in this case is an SU2, so it does behave a lot like angular momentum. So when you think about nucleons, you can think on this internal property of isospin the same way that you were thinking about the spin itself, the same way that you were talking about, for example, the spin angular momentum interactions, the Zeeman effect. All these things are going to be translatable into what happens to nucleons. So we will see those effects. And so that current, you can compute it, and it goes something like this, where these are taus. Okay, you see tau is appearing there, is the generator of SU2, and the current that is conserved on this SU2, the isospin current, does contain Ta. So it's a current that has a Lorentz index, so it's J mu, and has an SU2 index. That's the one of isospin. And the U1 part will also be important. This is what is called a baryonic, or baryon, and it will lead to baryon number, is the baryonic current. And that one is just one. It has just one generator, where this is A from 1, 2, and 3. For each of these matrices over here, for the baryonic case, we just have one. And it goes something like this, gamma mu inside. So those will be currents that are conserved. Remember, the conservation of a current is nothing but a statement about how the divergence is zero. You probably know as well that then you can deduce a set of conserved charges. Is anybody not knowing what I'm talking about? Everybody happy with this? If not, well, we can discuss it later on and I can give you references. But essentially, for example, for the case of the baryonic current, what this is telling you is there is will be a number, baryon number, that must be conserved in any nuclear interaction. And in particular, for example, if we think about neutrons, the way they decay, here it doesn't matter the flavor. Here we have baryon number one, and here we have baryon number one. Any process must conserve this current. But any process also must conserve isospin, which is a much more complicated kind of conservation. So based on this, there has been a lot of very successful ways of thinking about nuclear physics. But that's not all.
Is the charge associated with the baryon current just like plus one or zero, like baryon and not baryon? Okay.
Exactly. You can be a baryon, you can be an antibaryon, or you can be nothing. From the point of view that you want baryon. Very good. Okay, so just this leads to a lot of different consequences for phenomenology. And we can go even farther than that. What we can do is the following. First of all, we can also parameterize how badly we've done, right? We started by saying, we are going to assume a symmetry. That's the statement that, at least from the point of view of strong interactions, protons and neutrons are the same. Their masses are very close. And the things that distinguish protons and neutrons are actually its mass difference and the electromagnetic interactions. The quark content is different. So they are not exactly the same. So how do you think these differences will appear? So what will happen is that there will be violations of this conservation rule. There will be breakings, if you want, of these selection rules. But those will be always parameterized by some factor that depends on whatever is distinguishing neutrons from protons, whether it is the mass difference or the electric charge.
But the conservation of the isospin current, when you've got, you know, because you have three of them, JA, is each individually conserved or is it the sum of the three that's conserved?
So, here?
Yeah.
You have this thing here, and that's two for A from one, two, and three. So you have three of them.
Okay, so they're individually.
Exactly. So four of them in total, three plus one. And each of them leading to a charge, a conservation at this time. Any more questions? Yes.
So in relation to the previous question before that, why is the U1 charge an integer? And why is the U1 charge an integer?
So that's a bit, you want to, you can call the charge whatever you want, right? In the same way as yesterday, we were talking about there is a U1 associated with our fermionic action with the Dirac equation, where you have an I alpha psi, so an invariance under this U1. And then what it means, the interpretation you give to the corresponding conserved charge is this number of fermions. And that's the way you keep track of the fact that there is a conserved charge. This is just telling you that some quantity which is an integral of one of these currents over here, doesn't change with time.
Yeah, but how do you know that that integral evaluates to an integer or a rational number rather than a real number?
No, but you are labeling. You are just labeling. You are just saying, I have something with properties, for example, over here at the beginning, that has transformation properties under U1 variant. And I had to make sure that at the end, I also have something with transformation properties under U1 variant. So you want, when you think about this process of the neutron going to a proton, electron, and neutrino, you are also thinking that there is some kind of internal, if not, in this case, it's not fermion number, but it's baryon number that needs to be conserved along the line. Whether you call it 1 or 20, it doesn't matter. And maybe I'm not getting your question. It's not a question of calling it baryon number 1. It's up to you what you call it.
Would it be correct to say it's basically a normalization choice?
What you know is that there is a quantity whose time dependence is 0. Whereas you want this quantity or 20 times or a million times this quantity, doesn't matter. It's your labeling. And what I'm labeling is that there is a property, a transformation that this guy has that needs to be continued in any process. Charge quantization, and maybe you're thinking about the electric charge. That's yet another level of things.
Isn't it because it's like compact U1, V group, then it's like integers, not real numbers, as you said?
But you discretized. Maybe that's more the question.
Yeah, there's a difference between a rational number and a real number, right? And that's not just a normalization question. As in, you can normalize a rational number to be an integer, but not if it's a real number, right?
I guess I don't want...
The SU2 currents also integer, or are they real value?
I guess I don't want to be dragged... it's okay. I don't want to be dragged into a conversation when we get into a very interesting story where the SU2 behavior is very interesting. The topological behavior of SU2 is very interesting. And what you call baryon number and what kind of state and the name what you give to that is very interesting, because you could have very many types of vacua labeled with different number of baryon in it. The same for number of fermions and so on. But there's a lot of interesting things to say about that. I just don't want to get too entangled into it. For the moment, this is just a labeling in which you know that there is a quantity here that needs to be the same in the other side. And that way, pictorial way in which we do it is through an arrow. Any more questions? I hope I didn't cut the discussion. I mean, we can discuss a bit more, but. Okay, so that is for protons and neutrons. Now, yesterday we were discussing about forces. Somebody asked, oh, what about QCD at low energies? QCD at low energies is not mediated by gluons. The strong interaction at low energies is short range. And actually, the way we think about this, or one effective way in which we can think about it, is to think about nucleons actually experiencing the strong interactions through the exchange of pions. Remember that? And the pions are massive. Okay, so can we incorporate to this theory of neutrons and protons, this nuclear theory, those interactions? Can we do that? So for that, we need to think about pions. So as you know, there are these particles of spin zero. They are CP odd, and there are three of them at low energies. You also heard about kaons as well, right? So let's talk about pions just for the moment, because this is the simplest thing. Okay. Similarly to the case of the protons and neutrons, the mass of the pions are very similar. And you can imagine why. So both pions, pi plus and pi zero, all these guys are made of, or we think on the, of them as bounces of quarks, or bilinears in quarks. And the only thing that distinguishes them is electromagnetic interactions. And those are behind the reason why these two are not exactly the same, but they are quite close. So up to electromagnetic interactions, the masses of these guys are the same. So those are spin zero, those are cypiod, so, no, shouldn't say cypiod, pseudoscalar quantities, so the scalar particles. And we know how to write a theory for them. We can write a Lagrangian for a scalar, and that's gonna simply going to be the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. So the usual kinetic term and a mass term. I can do that for pi zero, I can do that for pi plus, I can do that for pi minus. They look exactly the same, and the only difference is the mass. But now we are going to take the approach that the mass is exactly the same. And then we are going to find what symmetries are then in this Lagrangian and what consequences those symmetries have. Same story. So now that we've seen that there is some kind of rotation we could make on the pions that will leave the Lagrangian invariant. So we have identified a symmetry. So we can do the following. We can write down a big vector that contains the pions. Now, the way I've written the pions is a bit convoluted because I'm going to put the pi plus and pi minus together. I'm going to do the following. So and then, so that's pi minus, and there is a plus and minus here, there is an I here. That's very typical. You often want to put two quantities that are related to each other. For example, pi plus and pi minus are related, obviously related to each other, through this kind of transformation. And then pi naught will be simply given by the third component. So you do that. It's just an intermediate trick to get a nicer equation. And you put this in a big vector of three components. And then what you realize is that when I write down the Lagrangian in terms of this object, my Lagrangian has a symmetry, which is I can rotate my three vector by an orthogonal matrix, and that is going to lead to exactly the same Lagrangian. So if I do that transformation, plug it into the Lagrangian, I end up with the same Lagrangian as before. So I've identified what are the symmetries of my Lagrangian. So O is an element of the orthogonal rotations in three dimensions. Now that sounds interesting because we already know that at the level of the Lie algebra, this O3 is isomorphous to SU2. So at that level, that is very, very U1D over there. What these pions are doing, their symmetry behavior is going to be related to what these nucleons are doing. Okay, so let's exploit that. We are going to exploit that to write possible interactions between the nucleons and our pions. Maybe I will go a bit faster on that. which is not like super core of what I want to do, but we are talking about nucleons. We wrote the Lagrangian of free nucleons, and we realized that in the limit that the mass of these neutrons, nucleons are the same, is the same, there is a symmetry SU2. We talked about pions. We were able to write a Lagrangian of free pions. And we realized that in the limit, indeed, of the mass of all pions being the same, there is a symmetry that is O3. So there must be a way of writing down interactions between these two sectors that are consistent with the symmetries of the nucleon sector and consistent with the symmetries of the pion sector.
I'm sorry, I think I missed something. Why does the isomorphism between those two groups mean that they have to interact?
They don't have to. They don't have to.
You just said that there has to be a way of writing down the interaction.
I'm going to be able to write down this interaction. So I'm going to be able to write a Lagrangian involving pions and nucleons that preserves the symmetries of the free Lagrangian of pions and free Lagrangian of nucleons. So I will have a big Lagrangian that is symmetric. That I can write it down doesn't mean that nature cares about that.
Okay.
We do know that we want to do that because we know that actually nucleons are made of quarks and gluons, pions are made of quarks and gluons as well. So they are made of the same thing, so they are going to talk to each other. All what I'm going to be able to do is to tell you exactly how they are going to talk to each other, and this will be thanks to this relation over here. So all in all, just imposing these symmetries, so the fact that we want the overall Lagrangian to preserve the symmetries of the nucleons and of the pions, there is only, and also the CP properties of your pion, there is only one term that I can write down. It's only one of them. And that's this one over here. The axial interaction between nucleons and my pion. And that's all. There is no other way in which they interact. So there's extremely predictive theory, which tells us exactly how, when the nucleons experience a strong interaction and they do it through this exchange of pions, in what structure there is going to appear. So my Lagrangian of interaction contains only this term over here. And it's all determined by symmetries. So although the generators of O3, if I write them down, they are generators of rotations in like in 3D. And although my generators of the nucleon rotations are the Pauli matrices, and they don't seem to be related to each other, they are actually related to each other because at the level of the Lie algebra, they are just generated by these Levi-Civita symbols. So you start then asking yourself, where is the variation of my Lagrangian under both O3 of pions and SU2 or U2 of nucleons? You will find out that it's zero.
Should there be a 5R somewhere? You've got an odd number of spinors in that object.
Should I mean this?
You've got psi bar, psi, and then phi.
Yeah, scalar.
It's a scalar field.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought that was a spinor.
No, no problem. I know the notation is always difficult. So those are just pions,
okay.
Scalar particles. It's our usual interaction. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
When you said it's the only term, are you just looking at renormalizable terms?
Exactly. Okay. I mean, I'm looking at the leading order ones.
Yeah.
You could think on higher terms with not just bilinear in the fermions. But what I want to represent is I have a nucleon, and I want to see how this nucleon is interacting. I want that term precisely. More questions. I could also have terms with more derivatives and so on, but that will be the leading order term. Okay, fine. So should we move into forces now?
What were you saying with this delta Grandjean? It's zero?
Yes, so the same way I'm trying to find symmetries of my action, or you want symmetries of my Lagrangian. And what I had to do is I take the fields in my Lagrangian and the space-time coordinates, and I apply transformations. So I go from psi, for example, to another psi, a new psi, that is some rotation, let's say, of the original psi. I plug it into the Lagrangian, and I see whether by doing that, I did nothing, essentially. So that's the meaning here. More questions? OK, so let's talk about forces and how they appear as yet another symmetry principle. At the end, a lot of our predictivity, coming back to this success of the standard model. Why is it so successful? Because we can actually measure things, and we can compute things that we can compare with. Right? So we need to be able to compute. And a lot of our computational power, if you want, comes from the use of symmetries and the use of luck. Luck in the sense that there is some kind of perturbative expansion that I can use. Whether it's a perturbative expansion because the coupling is small, so in the usual way, or it's a perturbative expansion because I'm doing an effective field theory, so I'm expanding in momentum, those are just, if you want, luck, because I'm in the region where I can do that, or nature chose those parameters that allow me to do this. Symmetries are extremely useful when you actually don't have that luck. And what I mean by that is, you are talking about the strong interactions, you are talking about mesons and baryons, those are a mess. And there is no lack there. The only thing you can do is symmetries. Okay, so let's now talk about gauge symmetries. We've been looking at the action, for example, for the Dirac Lagrangian. And then we realized that after imposing Lorentz symmetry, an accidental symmetry came out. The same Lagrangian and those terms in the Dirac equation, those had an additional symmetry that we hadn't imposed. It just appeared as a byproduct. And that symmetry was something where I could take my fermion, now this is a fermion, and I could just rotate it by a phase. And the Lagrangian of the Dirac equation will be exactly the same. And then I say, OK, I'm going to interpret this. I'm going to call it, say that this corresponds to a conserved current, and this conserved current has a conserved quantity, and this conserved quantity is a fermion number. So we already know that the fermion fields, when you write down a consistent Lorentz invariant theory for fermions, you had this symmetry over there that you interpret as the fermion number. Now, when doing that, I'm assuming that the parameter here, alpha, is a constant. I'm assuming that this transformation is, in other words, global. Same over here, when I was talking about the properties of the nucleon theory, and I was talking about baryon number, baryon current, and the isospin current, I was thinking of rotations in the internal space that do not depend on space-time. So all these isospin, all these O3 of pions are global symmetries of this theory. Okay? But now what we are going to do is try to promote this to something that depends on space and time. See if we can do that. So we take the Lagrangian that we had before, the one that contains a kinetic term and that contains a mass term. And we are going to reimpose this symmetry we talked about yesterday, but now with an alpha that varies with the space and time. So instead of thinking of you wanting the field space, let's say this is a space and time, I'm thinking about having, for example, an electron, a field of an electron, and I'm thinking about rotating this field everywhere by exactly the same quantity, this phase over here. And I'm saying, okay, when I do this, actually the physics stays exactly the same. And fermion number conservation is nothing but a manifestation of this fact. I'm going to now try to generalize this, to think about a transformation that I do on the fields. But now this transformation is going to vary depending on the position. Is this still a symmetry? Is nature still having this as a symmetry? So I take a space-time, I think about, in this case, a fermion field. I know that if I just Lorentz symmetry tells me that by varying at each position by the same quantity, all the fermion fields, I'll get the same theory. Is there anything that I can do to also vary in a different way, every way in space-time, and still have a symmetry? The answer will be yes, but you will have to call for help. You will be able to do that. So you are going to be able to think about symmetries that depend, the parameters themselves depend on the position in space-time, but to a cost. Okay? So let me see. All right. I don't want to spend a lot of time doing this derivation because I guess, well, I bet you have seen this before. Had you been introduced to gauge symmetries? Yes, very well.
Yeah. Is this, like, the first time I saw this, I was confused. Is this also, like, an accidental, is this, like, luck that nature says, like, we have this local symmetry if we put in these gauge bosons? Like, it seems like the way are they motivated, it's like, let's just promote this and see what happens. But, like, what's the intuition? Like, why should it have a local symmetry also?
I was also confused the same way, right? And I guess it's a bit the way I view it, right? It's our task. So my task is I want to see how far I can go, how many symmetries I can find that are still realized in nature. And not so much asking nature what it's doing or not doing. I just want to make sure that I exploit everything and see whether nature is still doing it. One example is supersymmetry. It would be great if nature had it. We don't know, but we go, we see, and then we look at the experiment. Here is the same. We know that just the fact that nature preserves Lorentz invariance tells me that fermionic fields will have this global symmetry. Fermion number, this is my interpretation. This is the way I discovered that there is something behind the fermion number conservation. That's a manifestation of asymmetry. Now I want to say, well, so let's try to do something more complicated and see whether nature is still doing it. And what is going to happen is that it isn't still doing it, but it is precisely what we observe. We see forces, and forces are precisely the manifestation of nature wanted to do this. That's the way I will interpret it, but I'm sure there's more ways of thinking about it. Okay? So at the beginning, and the way it's introduced, and when I teach this course, is the same, is that let's do it and see what happens. But at the end is, we do it, see what happens, and see whether nature is actually realizing this symmetry. The same way that it could be doing supersymmetry, but it's not doing so. As far as we know, it's not doing it. Okay, so if we promote, as you say, this parameter to be a space-time dependent, what we are going to find is that there, as you know, we look at the variation of our Dirac Lagrangian respect to this symmetry, so respect to this parameter alpha, and we see that there is 0, 0, 0, and then there is an additional term that looks like something proportional to the derivative of the parameter itself. So if I call this guy over here my transformation u, and now this guy depends on x, I'm going to see that by transforming the fermion fields in the Dirac equation, in the Dirac Lagrangian, I will get something that vanishes up to these derivatives respect to u, spacetime of u. So then you will say, okay, so that means that nature does not preserve this symmetry. This gauge symmetry is not a symmetry of nature. But that's because I'm considering a Lagrangian that contains one species, and in this case, it's a fermionic field. A spin one half particle. So my theory of matter does not have local symmetry in it. But as you probably have seen already before, I can make it work. I can actually impose that symmetry if I provide yet another Lagrangian. That would be a Lagrangian that contains spin one particles. Those spin one particles have to be of a specific kind. They have to transform it in a specific form so that their own variation makes this additional term vanish, so that the full Lagrangian containing fermion fields, spin one fields, and interactions between those two, those preserve the U1 symmetry. I can do the math for you, or as long as you feel we could do this together, that you could sit down and do this calculation. Essentially, that's all. You start with a Lagrangian for Dirac fields. You see that there is a remaining part. Then you start, then write down a Lagrangian of free spin one particles that also preserve U1. And then you realize that there is also, well, essentially there is nothing left. But I can then write an interaction between these two. And this interaction is uniquely determined because you want to make this disappear. So the forces we experience are given, the form of those forces, the fact that they are there, the fact that they are mediated by spin one particles, are precisely given by our need to impose a symmetry. So in other words, this local symmetry, it is realized in nature, and their manifestation are those forces. This derivative, this trick of derivative going to covariant derivative, where this guy now contains interactions, is precisely that statement. The covariant derivative is there just to make sure, or is the only structure I can write that is consistent with the whole thing having this local U1 symmetry. So you could say that I can impose a U1 local symmetry to a fermion field. I'm going to then discover that I need to write a theory of not just one fermion, but also a spin one particle with very specific interactions. I can then write the Lagrangian that you usually write for QED. You can then write your spin one particle and decompose it in the usual way you will do for classical mechanics in terms of electric and magnetic fields. You can then use this Lagrangian to write down your Maxwell's equations So again, all your electrodynamics and all the suffering you had in second year or whatever it was, all this comes from that, imposing a U1 local symmetry. That determines the way these spin-1 particles, what is the Lagrangian they have. It determines those equations. It determines how they couple to matter. It determines everything. It's just a symmetry. And it's all coming from top to down. And that's, yeah.
This is possibly an irrelevant question, but I want to ask some conversation with somebody about whether or not there was anything in physics you could not eventually derive using the combination of least action principle and Noether's theorem. And you couldn't come up with any examples of any laws in physics that were not eventually a consequence of those two principles.
But you know, there are assumptions there that you can write an action that then you can vary, and then you can find the vacuum, and then you can find the equations of motion from it. It means that you are able to write specific degrees of freedom.
Okay.
Now, in strong interactions, for example, you might not have states that you call states, right? So you might not be able to write your nice Lagrangian as being field and derivative. You might not be able to do this because there is no such a description in terms of individual degrees of freedom. So think, for example, of QCD. You know, when you look at the resonances of QCD, you see, for example, the row, all the pions over here, the A1, you start going up, and then you stop seeing states themselves. You see a continuum of stuff. And that's what we do try to do. We try to parameterize this. So we don't see resonances in the way you will see something with a given mass and a small width. We are then talking about essentially a bunch of rubbish. And in that case, how do you write a Lagrangian for that? How do you write an action? How do you? You can still, there are other analytical methods you can use, non-perturbative methods, but not the ones I'm talking about. Yeah. More questions? Cool. Is this clear to you? Have you seen this kind of derivation before? Or you start with U1, you get all the Maxwell equations and so on. Okay. So that's the, right now you are being told this in a half an hour or even 10 minutes way, because you already have all the engineering that is needed to understand it. You know some field theory, classical field theory. We've been talking about symmetries and so on. But it took some time for people to actually realize and being able to find this way, the way of symmetries. So from this U1 and the case of QED, we can go into more complicated stuff. So instead of being just a face, we could think then of U as being part of another group, a non-abelian group. For example, U could be part of an SU2 group. And again, the elements that you are using to vary this SU2 group, so the parameters over here, they could be alpha A, TA, where these are the generators of SU2, and these guys could depend on the spacetime. So you can easily generalize this to non-abelian theories, SU2 and higher, and also theories that are not necessarily of the type SU, but any other kind of groups, for example, SO, SP, and so on and so forth. And you will get similar things. So you will say, what if nature had an internal symmetry that was of the type SU5, for example? And then you will go and see how you can write consistent theories of fermions and interactions and scalars and so on that preserve this local SU5 theory, and then you will get a lot of consequences of it. And you will compare with the experiment with what we see in nature, and you will end up seeing that there is some kind of inconsistency, or that there is something that we haven't seen. And then you will discard this kind of stuff. So it's not that nature realizes every possible symmetry we can think of. It's only so far doing the standard model is doing SU3. We know that there is an SU2 sorry, left first U1, hypercharge. And we know there is gravity. And although gravity is not something that we can, for the moment, promote to our quantum theory, we know that gravity is also a consequence of symmetries. In this case, it's of an invariance of diffeomorphism. So when you impose diffeomorphism invariance, you will get the theory of gravity, which again, something coming from top down. The only difference between these and those, apart from this being quite complicated, is that these guys, we know how to promote them to quantum theories. So we can take this analysis that we've done in terms of symmetries and promote it to the quantum level. When it comes to gravity, as you know, there are issues with doing that. I had the impression that I'm more and more having a monologue. Are you okay? Yes? Just tired? Very good. Any questions? Yes.
Were the kinetic terms, it's been a while since I did that local symmetry.
Yeah.
Are the kinetic terms conserved under the local symmetry of U1?
So
it's just the interaction term, but it's not. And then you add a term to that you define as the covariant derivative. Oh. Stick into your kinetic terms.
So the way you start is you say, well, let me put the Lagrangian of the fermion that contains the kinetic term and the mass term. Under this local transformation, the mass term is doing great. No problem. But it's this derivative that is messing up things.
Okay.
So when you take that derivative, there is going to be a remaining, essentially derivative, acting on your generator itself. On your parameter itself. So there is there. So meaning that when I take a variation respect to this parameter, I don't get zero. I get this leftover. And that's why I need to add interactions. I need to add interactions with what? With a specific creature. And that creature has to be this vector field that has exactly the properties needed to make this cancel. So interactions then appear as a consequence of having an overall theory that is invariant. More questions?
Well, SU4, you said SU5 doesn't work, but...
I don't know if it works. Listen, SU5 might work at high energies. It might be a good symmetry, but it's broken at low energies. I'm pausing a bit because what I'm going to do now is to break. I'm going to break things. So let's break things. Degrees of freedom, that's great. By the way, there is a, you think about this as coming from symmetries, and you can even then think about all these symmetries from a very geometrical, mathematical perspective. You can think of vector fields as the force mediators, not as even like the things we measure, these photons, these W's, these Z's, they will be a description, mathematical description in terms of differential geometry, fiber bundles, all kinds of very mathematical cute stuff. So there is as an even in more interesting structure behind what I'm saying, if you're really keen into this kind of stuff. So let me... Okay, so now we are going to do some breaking of symmetries. Enough of preserving them. So what we've seen so far is that the symmetries that are preserved, space-time symmetries, internal symmetries, and so on, are extremely predictive. It tells us a lot of things that we knew already. The Dirac equation, the transformations, Lorentz transformations, and so on. It allows us to compute things in theories that otherwise would be not, you know, very difficult to deal with. For example, nuclear physics, when we are talking about strong interactions and things that are essentially a mess of quarks and gluons, symmetries are a way of finding predictive ways to compute things. But even if you go and break them, you still gain predictivity, because you know there are some points that your theory, even if it has a symmetry that is broken, or you can think on this symmetry as not being there, you know that in some limit of these theories, you will recover a symmetry. So knowing that is super important. So interesting things happen when we think about symmetries and we break them in a way that is called spontaneous. So far we've seen Lagrangians or actions where we had some set of particles and set of interactions that preserve some symmetry. As in the case of the nucleons and pions, we said, well, that symmetry, there's U2 and L3 of pions, those symmetries are not exact. Actually, I know that there is another part of my theory, another sector of my theory, for example, in this case of electromagnetic interactions, that break the symmetry. So the symmetry I'm talking about for nuclear interactions, so for nucleons and for pions, contains that symmetry that is only approximate. And I know that is an explicit breaking of that symmetry every time I think, for example, of the electromagnetic charge alpha E. So what I can do is to essentially compute things in this area using symmetry arguments and then parameterize possible deviations from my computations as something that has to be proportional to the parameter that breaks the symmetry. Because this parameter is small, then I know that I can do this parametrization and be quite accurate. That's good, but that's not the most interesting thing that can happen. That explicit breaking is something that we can deal with by, you know, doing an iterative expansion and so on and so forth. But the interesting dynamics happen when we think about spontaneous breaking. The idea of spontaneous breaking is that you will have your Lagrangian, and your Lagrangian, your theory, it is symmetric. So that's fine. But when you are thinking about computing something in physics, the Lagrangian is not enough. You need to understand as well where is the vacuum of your theory. Essentially, when I'm thinking about particles, when I'm thinking about producing excitations, I'm thinking about taking the vacuum of my theory, and I'm doing some kind of using, for example, in the context of quantum field theory, you will think about annihilation and creation operators to from the vacuum state to then produce a one particle state or a 10 particle state. And you can also destroy particles by doing exactly the same. So from the vacuum is where you build your quantum field theories. So you start with the vacuum, create something, or destroy something. But it's always from that vacuum. The first thing you need to do, you will need to do to think about a process, a scattering, decays, the creation and annihilation of particles, is to understand your vacuum over here. So usually vacuums are not that interesting. You vacuum, think of the state, the configuration with the minimum energy. And they are just, you know, usually they are given by vacuum equals everybody is zero. There is nothing. But actually the vacuum of that we live in right now, the vacuum of the standard model, is more interesting than that. You know that already. You heard about the Higgs mechanism or learned about the Higgs mechanism. What the Higgs mechanism does is to make this vacuum more interesting. And what it does is the vacuum of the theory is not going to possess the same symmetries as the Lagrangian itself. There is nothing written in the Lagrangian that violates asymmetry, but the vacuum does. So that's the idea. A spontaneous breaking of a symmetry is when there is the vacuum that breaks the symmetry. By breaking the symmetry, what I mean is that the vacuum state is not invariant under the symmetry. If I apply the symmetry, let's say a rotation or whatever, this state is not going to keep being the same.
If the theory is symmetric, how can the vacuum of the theory not? How can something that is a part of the greater symmetric thing violate that?
We'll see that in a second, but it comes when you have a theory that has an interesting set of possibilities for the vacuum, some type of degeneracy, choices that I could make, and I realize that any choice I make, and you need to make one, not you, but the nature needs to make one, any choice will break that symmetry. So it only happens when you have an interesting set of choices. So shall we do this example? Okay, let's do a very simple example, which is a scalar theory with a discrete symmetry. So let's not even embark yet into the case of the standard model. So let's say I have a real scalar. Oh, let me pause for a second. I'm saying that for spontaneous symmetry breaking to happen, I need the vacuum to be interesting. For the vacuum to be interesting, I need some field to not just be zero at in the vacuum. Some field needs to have some interesting dynamics in it. Now, if we think about the vacuum and we think on fields that could have a non-zero behavior in the vacuum, if, for example, I try to do that with a fermion field, or for a vector field. So if I had tried to create an interesting vacuum made of one guy like this or one guy like this, because they do have properties, transformation properties, and then the Lorentz symmetry, those might be a bit more hidden because they come through this spinor over here, but they still transform under the Lorentz symmetry. If I did that, it will mean that I'm breaking Lorentz invariants. So I can't generate or start with a theory of an interesting vacuum with fermion fields, with spin one fields or spin two fields and so on. I cannot do that with guys that behave in or transform in any way under the Lorentz symmetry. So the only objects, fields, that can lead to an interesting phenomenology or an interesting vacuum are scalar. That doesn't mean that they have to be fundamental scalars, right? For example, a quark condensate, the vacuum of QCD, is made of quarks, spin one half particles, but its bound states are scalar again. Okay, so having said that, we are going to think about spontaneous symmetry breaking for scalars. So let's take a real scalar. And we write the Lagrangian for a real scalar. Because it's real, remember it has this factor one half. And then we have that guy as well. And then we have some kind of potential. Okay? This potential could be anything. But we are going to say that my scalar somehow has a symmetry, that's called Z2. And what this symmetry is an invariant, so everything stays the same even when I change my scalar by a minor sign. That's my Z2, that's just the Z2. It's a typical type of symmetry, it's also sometimes called parity. Is used a lot in dark matter, for example, for stabilization. Well, okay, so if my real scalar has a Z2 and I start thinking about what kind of things I can write in my potential, well, obviously, this term, the kinetic term, satisfies the Z2. So what kind of terms do I get there? Well, I get a master. And I will get to the next order. I cannot get three fields because that violates set two. So the next term is something that looks like an interaction. And then I could have other things, for example, pi to the 6, pi to the 8, and so on and so forth. I'm not considering these terms of higher because, as you know, those guys are will be suppressed by a mass scale. So I can always neglect them as long as I'm looking at low energies. Now I'm looking at low energies because I'm going to examine the vacuum structure of this theory. I'm going to look at very, very low energies. Okay, so I'm going to restrict myself to these two only possibilities over here, the mass term and some interaction. Okay, any questions? Now, so let's examine the vacuum of this theory. And in other words, go and minimize this potential. You've done this many, many times, I bet. So you look for values of the mass coupling and values of the field that minimizes V. So you look at the first derivative of the potential respect to the field. You say you look at the second derivative. You set this to zero and look for what field configurations satisfy this. And once you do that, you plug it in the second derivative, in the Hessian of this guy, and see whether it's positive or negative. So you know that these fields will be an extreme of this potential, but it could be a maximum or a minimum. So you impose one of them. You want a minimum. Okay. So what you get is something like the first equation is, let me put just the usual 4 factorial over here, just to, not that it matters. And the second term is simply n squared plus 4 times 3 4 factorial lambda pi squared. Okay, and we want to know whether this is positive or negative. And you've probably seen this kind of a story before, right? When you were thinking about the Higgs. So for the first equation, the equation of having an extreme, minimum or maximum, you realize that there are two possibilities. Phi equals zero is the trivial one. That will lead to the trivial vacuum, not the one we want. And then you could also have a solution if phi, or a couple of solutions actually, a phi square will be essentially minus 6m square over lambda. And that's possible, so this solution is possible if m squared is negative, and then you talk about tachyons, and then you realize that there is no tachyonic state, and so on and so forth. Is everybody happy with this, or should I go? Yes.
I'm just a little bit confused. When you haven't done anything to quantize the field phi, there are no creation and annihilation operators. And when you say the vacuum, I think of a state in a Hilbert space that's annihilated by all the operators. How does that come about from this minimizing of the potential? And also the phi isn't a real number, it's a field. So how do you take a derivative of V with respect to the field and set it equal to zero, it seems like?
Very good. So confusing to me. I understand. So you start with a Lagrangian and this. It's just a classical Lagrangian. There is no quantum on it. Now I'm going to find the configurations in field space for this field that have a non-trivial vacuum. And by vacuum, I mean a non-trivial state of minimum energy. That then, when I do a quantum field theory, I'm going to promote into what I call a vacuum. So this is all classical, and that's right. Thank you for pointing it out. It's all classical, completely like pedestrian thing that anybody could do. This is an analysis that you will do to examine the structure, what are the states that lead to minimum energy? And from those will be the ones that will be promoted to vacuum states. And again, as you were saying, once I know what kind of phi is in the vacuum, I can start thinking about creating and annihilating phi particles from that vacuum. I need to first understand where is the minimum energy, and that will be given by this value. And then any creation of annihilation of particles of this guy will come from excitations from that minimum energy. So you will think on the quantum state phi of x, the particle if you want, as being created from wherever was this background configuration final. That was the state of minimum energy. So I'm kind of a sloppy, because it's what everybody does anyway, borrowing the intuition you already have about the vacuum and how you had done this, the quantization in quantum field theory, where you think about a field, phi, for example, being made of an infinite sum of creation and annihilation operators acting on the vacuum. So you already have that intuition. And I'm just focusing on the idea of the vacuum itself. And the vacuum needs to be built from whatever is the state of the field and minimum energy. Yes?
Maybe
so
when we go to this lambda is negative, then you get
tachyon
states, but I feel like
that's
to be the other. Okay.
No, what happens is if lambda is negative, you will have a potential that is runaway.
Okay.
You need a potential that has a minimum, so you can start oscillating around. So lambda has to be positive.
Yes. So you do need to have an imaginary phi at the minimum.
So you need... No, precisely.
Phi squared is equal to a negative number.
Remember, I'm asking...
You have phi squared equal to a negative number.
Wait. I'm starting from a real scalar.
Okay.
It has to be real.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I'm saying that I know by looking at the potential that it better be that lambda is positive.
Okay.
And this phi has to be real. So indeed, this negative over here has to be compensated by some negative, and that is going to be this.
Okay.
So m squared, this solution only exists if m squared is negative. Okay?
So you need an imaginary mass?
Is an imaginary, very good. So I was assuming everybody saw this before, but it's an imaginary mass parameter in your Lagrangian. So you wrote down, not you, I did. I wrote down this Lagrangian. Now I'm saying that this guy has to be negative for this non-trivial vacuum to exist. Now, what is this Lagrangian term? I wrote down m squared because everybody is so used to think about the mass. You think on this as in Feynman diagrams, it will be this guy that propagates, is the one that if you then do a partial wave decomposition, this guy will appear as the mass in your E equals P plus m, P squared plus m squared, right? But that's not true everywhere. It's not true always, right? And in particular, you have... Now you are thinking about a vacuum that is non-trivial. And instead of just inspecting the potential as it is, you need to actually take this potential, take second derivatives of this potential, and look at the eigenvalues. And that is what is going to give you the mass of the states over there. And what happens is that when you are actually looking at particles phi that have been created from that vacuum, that is not at zero, is over there, is at a non-zero value, the mass states are positive. The physical m squared is positive. It's non-tachyonic, although the mass squared is negative, and the inspection of this potential will tell you, oh, tachyons. It is not true, because the way you see something propagating is because you create it from the vacuum and started moving along. But that guy, this phi, sorry, the phi that will be created from that vacuum will start already coming up from a higher value. So their mass is going to be positive, mass square positive. No imaginary, no tachyons, nothing. It's all normal physics. Let's see if I can just quickly finish this. So it's a real scalar. I realized that it could be an interesting set of vacua if I had m squared this parameter to be negative, then I will have possibilities that are this scalar field being non-zero at the minimum. In fact, how many possibilities do I have? How many non-trivial vacua do I have? Two? I heard two? Yeah. So I have, if I plotted something like this is my field, and this is the potential as a function of the value of the field. All what I'm saying is that for m squared negative, so for m squared positive, and remember this is just a parameter in my potential, there is only one vacuum, and it's over here. For m squared negative, the zero is now a maximum, not a minimum, and there are two possible minima, phi plus and phi minus. Now, if I want to start using this vacuum, one of these two, to do my quantum field theory, and I want to start creating these scalar particles from my vacuum, I had to choose which one. I had to say I'm going to write a field theory that starts from phi plus or phi minus. And then my physical, if you want, scalar field will be the scalar field that appears in that Lagrangian when I have subtracted the minimum, either phi plus or minus. Okay, so the non-trivial vacuum, the fact that we are here or here, the fact that phi at the minimum is non-zero, is what we call a vacuum expectation value, or a VEF. You heard about this many times. For a real scalar with this kind of potential, it's not like for the Higgs, it's much, much simpler. It simply has two options. It's either this one or this one. Now, whatever I do, I'm going to break the symmetry. Before I examine the vacuum, I see that both this and this are symmetric. My potential is symmetric under the Z2. I can do like this with my potential. The Lagrangian is symmetric under Z2. I haven't done anything. It's still Z2 symmetric. It is me, as a field theorist, that have to make that choice, start here and then creating particles in that area, or here and creating particles in that area, that I have broken the symmetry only at the vacuum level. And that's called a spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now, for the case of this Z2, there are physical consequences. So what I'm saying right now is that there is a scalar field, real scalar field out there. It gets a non-trivial vacuum. And it means that it has two possible choices. So the vacuum could be made of phi plus or phi minus. Imagine this scalar field is some kind of state in the early universe, high temperatures, everything is beautiful, and so on. And at some point, as we go to lower and lower temperatures, then we end up with this kind of potential. And then this scalar field then starts, you has to decide where it's going to be sitting, whether in phi plus or phi minus. So you think on, let's say, a patch of the universe over here, there might be that in this patch of the universe, the vacuum is going to be phi plus, whereas in this other patch of the universe, this vacuum is going to be phi minus. And over here, and over here, and over here. So as the universe cools down, what do you think is going to happen? What is going to be? What are going to be the consequences of having different patches of the universe sitting in different vacua?
Tunneling potentially.
Do you mean like from when in the boundary regions between these two, let's say this 5 minus 5 minus?
Yeah.
You will have the situation that to go from one to the other, you will have this barrier over here.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So they lead to stuff like domain walls, which is a very interesting feature that could have happened in the early universe. And we haven't seen. We don't see actually any indication of domain walls in the sky, in the CMB and so on. So actually, that's another good feature about inflation. It might get rid of these domain walls for us. But having a Z2 symmetry for a scalar, having these two options will lead to, if this scalar is abundant in the universe, you will typically find a set of domain walls. You can compute the density of those domain walls, and there are, of course, people who don't agree with each other. But then you can look for them because, you know, these guys at some point are going to destroy themselves and produce, essentially inject energy into the CMB, and we don't see those features. So then you need to do something with it and so on. So there are asymmetry, the analysis of the vacuum, and the simple observation that since both of them are equally probable, if I just look at the sky, I should see patches of different values. Hence, as you see on the boundaries, domain walls lead to lots of physical consequences that occupied a lot of physicists for a long time. Okay? I think that's enough. Sorry, I took a bit too much time. So when we come back later at 12:30, we'll finally do the Higgs mechanism. And then we'll talk a little bit about what is next, what kind of things we are doing nowadays.